Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 178 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be going into the USMLE Step 1 cardiology review. This will be Series 7. And in this podcast, I'll be talking about cardiovascular pathology, although I will spend more time on the vascular part of cardiovascular. I think it's imperative that I discuss, the vascular issues and, kind of put everything hopefully together. And you'll find this to be useful for your exam. Cardio is just a very broad, expansive subject. And again, I want to hopefully try to do a decent job in terms of getting everything together. So the very first thing I want to go ahead and start with is, let's just talk about what, like if you're looking at a blood vessel, right, especially like an artery, right, what are the three major parts of an artery, right? So the three major parts of an artery, right, there's the intima, there's the media, and then there's the adventitia, right? There's the intima that's usually thin, it's lined by endothelial cells, okay? And then we have the media, and the media is made of smooth muscle, right? And hopefully you remember that the media is kind of like limited by, like, right after the intima, you have the internal elastic lamina, and then you have the media, and then after that you have the external elastic lamina, and then after that you have the adventitia. Remember, the adventitia contains like nerves, contains blood vessels. Those blood vessels tend to be known as the vasa visorum, which, as you'll see later, is attacked by syphilis, especially like in the aorta, right? The ascending aorta and the aortic arch. So that those are all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind. And again, the thing is, right, if you're sort of going from the heart, we have the aorta, and then, you know, you form all these like smaller muscular arteries, and then after that you form an arteriole, and then you have a capillary, and then you have a venule. Well, the thing is, the primary, this is actually very high yield to know for step one, but the primary means of control of blood pressure happens at the level of the arteriole, okay? The arteriole is where blood pressure, like arterioles are resistance vessels. That's where blood pressure control is primarily regulated. And then if you want to keep this at the back of your mind, like venules, like your veins, they are capacitance vessels. They have the ability to hold blood. They can hold large amounts of blood because they are very distensible. They have a lot of compliance. And if you wanted to integrate this with pharmacology, right? If they were to ask you on the USMLE Step 1 about the mechanism behind the peripheral edema that's observed in people that have... that are taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like amlodipine or felodipine. The mechanism there is that those drugs are dilators of precapillary arterioles, right? So they dilate precapillary arterioles. If you dilate precapillary arterioles, if you think about it, the hydrostatic pressures within the capillaries will increase, and that will cause fluid extravasation, and that will ultimately cause edema. So the corollary to that is that you can actually treat the peripheral edema associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker by dilating the postcapillary venules, and you do that with an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. So if you dilate those postcapillary venules, you'll decrease the capillary hydrostatic pressures, and that would help with that peripheral edema. So that's a nice way. Your friends at the MBME, they love to integrate this stuff. Now, the thing is, one big topic that they love to test on the MBMEs, right, revolves around this process of atherosclerosis, right? So this process of atherosclerosis. So the thing is, it's actually a process you want to make sure you actually understand, like from beginning to end, like how it sort of like progresses, right? So the thing is, atherosclerosis for the most part starts when you have a fatty streak on a blood vessel, right? You'll have a fatty streak on a blood vessel. If you know people that are pretty young that have, you know, relatively clean blood vessels, they're pretty healthy, they may have like a few fatty streaks here and there on their blood vessels. But as people get older, right, especially again if you're very unhealthy, right, you can begin to get into a lot of trouble with atherosclerosis. So the thing that happens is that these are fatty streaks, right? For the most part, they contain like LDL cholesterol and all that badness. And the thing is, if you then partner up that the presence of that fatty streak with some kind of endothelial dysfunction. So what do I mean by endothelial dysfunction, right? So things like certain toxins that's found in like cigarette smoke, right? Or anything that for whatever reason causes like dysfunction of like the endothelial surface. Well, that endothelial surface is exposed to that fatty streak. That fatty streak can begin to go from the intima and go into the media, right? And the thing is, even while it's a fatty streak, right, it can be oxidized, right? You have like oxidized LDL in a sense. It goes into the media. And then when you have that endothelial injury, right, a lot of things are released, like certain like chemotactic factors and whatnot that attract macrophages. When those macrophages show up, well, macrophages, their main job in life is to eat things. They eat that oxidized LDL. And if they eat that oxidized LDL, they become something known as a foam cell. Okay? They form something known as a foam cell. And those foam cells, right? The thing that can happen is, again, you can begin to release factors like platelet-derived growth factor and all that stuff that can then tell some of those smooth muscle cells that are in the media to start laying a lot of like fibrous tissue, right? And that's what ultimately forms the fibrous cap that underlies an atheroma, okay? An atheroma is just almost like an inward distension of a blood vessel, because the media has, in addition to the smooth muscles you already have in media, the media has already been taken over by those macro, sometimes they call those special macrophages that eat up the LDL cholesterol. They are known as a foam cells, right? So it's all stable and everything in that region. So you form that atheroma. But the thing is, that atheroma, I mean, if it's big enough, it can begin to occlude a blood vessel, and that can begin to cause symptoms, right? So say for example, if you have this in the coronary vessels, if an atheroma is already occluding like 70% of the diameter of a blood vessel, then that's gonna cause angina, right? You generally need about 70% stenosis to begin to cause angina. Now, one high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that if you decrease the diameter or the radius, let's say the radius, if you decrease the radius of a blood vessel by one half, you actually increase the resistance in that blood vessel by a factor of 8. Okay, that's a very high yield relationship. You definitely want to make sure that you know on your exam. Now, what are some things that contribute to the stability of an atheroma? This is something they love to test on exams, right? One big one you want to keep at the back of your mind is the thickness or the strength of the fibrous cap, okay? Because if something has like a thick fibrous cap, like a very strong fibrous cap, then it's unlikely to rupture. Because the thing is, if an atheroma ruptures, then you have the release of substances that can trigger primary hemostasis and secondary hemostasis. And if you form a thrombus at that level, at the level of the atheroma, then that's one of the things that can cause like an acute vascular syndrome, right? So say for example, a person has like a history of like a angina, like, you know, they're like, oh, I have chest pain when I work, when I participate in any kind of activity, and then it kind of gets better with rest, right? That's angina. And like I said, that typically happens when you have like an atheroma that's occluding, you know, like a pretty big chunk, like 70% or more of the lumen of a blood vessel, like a coronary artery, right? So the thing that happens is, if you get into a situation where the atheroma sort of like explodes, you form a thrombus that can cause like an acute coronary syndrome, like an end STEMI or a STEMI, right? So that's typically how that kind of progresses. And one high yield thing, kind of unusual, that your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know, is that when, like, one thing that can contribute to the degeneration of the fibrous cap and ultimate, like, pretty much like explosion of an atheroma for an acute thrombus to form, one big thing that can play a role in that is an increased expression of something known as a matrix metalloproteinase. Okay, a matrix metalloproteinase. That's actually something high yield you want to keep in mind. They love to test that on exams, but for whatever bizarre reason, you don't tend to find that in too many study resources. And I mean, obviously, what are the lifestyle habits that can contribute to the formation of an atheroma? Well, I mean, all the bad things you can think about, right? Like hyperlipidemia, you smoke. Smoking causes endothelial dysfunction, hypertension, right? Hypertension also causes endothelial dysfunction. If you're obese, if you've got diabetes, right? All these things can kind of cause a lot of trouble. And you may say, okay, Divine, how do I deal with this so that I don't develop all these atheromas all over my body? Well, just do the things that you hear on the news all the time that can maintain good health, right? Exercise regularly, right? 30 minutes, at least 5 days a week, right? And then also try to reduce how much you consume, right? There's actually been a lot of studies that show that the only thing that's been shown to improve like a person's longevity is caloric restriction, right? So I'm not saying become an anorexic, no, right? But you know, eat within reason. You don't need to eat 3,000 calories at every meal kind of deal. And actually, if you exercise a lot and you eat healthy, if you already have an atheroma, you can actually regress over time. You can actually regress over time. That's actually something high you ought to know. Now, one thing that your friends at the MBME love to test occasionally is, what if they give you a question about a person, you know, this person had an MI, and then they tell you that this person, they went for cardiac catheterization and stent placement, and then they tell you that this person's creatinine has been rising, and this person's toes look blue, and they look almost like gangrenous, like necrotic in a sense. And the person is having like severe, like lower extremity pain. Well, I would hope you're thinking about a cholesterol. Under those circumstances, you're thinking about something known as a cholesterol embolization syndrome. The thing that typically happens to cause cholesterol embolization syndrome is that in the process of cardiac catheterization, you know, as you're like nudging at the vessel, you can squirt off some cholesterol emboli. And those things can begin to occlude small vessels. Okay, it can occlude renal vessels, so that can cause like an acute kidney injury. And it can also occlude small vessels, especially in the lower extremities, and that can cause like digital or like distal ischemia. So you may say, where does that cholesterol come from? Well, the cholesterol comes from the atheroma. Okay, the cholesterol comes from the atheroma. Because if you actually look occasionally on the MBME, they may give you like histology images, pictures. So they can show you like a histology picture, and you may look at a blood vessel and you may be like, I'm seeing all these white lines within the blood vessel. Well, those are things known as cholesterol clefts. Okay, those are things known as cholesterol clefts. Those are pathognomonic for an atheroma. If you see those in the walls of a blood vessel, just a lot of like longitudinal white spaces, pretty much. That tells you that you're dealing with an atheroma. So you want to make sure that you can actually identify that on an MBME exam, right? And again, like I said, those macrophages, they consume the oxidized LDL cholesterol, right? And then those macrophages, they secrete all these cytokines, like platelet-derived growth factor, that then causes the smooth muscle cells in the media to differentiate into almost like fibroblasts, and they start secreting like all these weird stuff, and then they form the fibrous cap that then ultimately leads to the formation of the atheroma. So again, I know you may say, Divine, you know, you've kind of said this a lot of times. Again, I'm not saying this because I love to hear myself speak. Saying this because this is something that is tested frequently, but people seem to not pay attention to. People get this stuff wrong all the time. So again, you don't want to be one of those people. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that? So what if you get a question about? What if you get a question about like a 25-year-old guy? They tell you that you know he goes underwater diving, and then about 15 minutes after it comes up to the surface, he starts complaining of like severe chest pain, and then he suddenly becomes comatose and dies. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about something called a Caisson's disease. Okay, some people call it the bends, but basically the thing that happens, right? If you remember, I think from undergrad, because again, I tutor people in chemistry, there's this thing known as Henry's law, right? And in Henry's law, basically, as you exert more pressure over a fluid surface, right, you can dissolve more gas in that fluid. So here's the deal. When you descend to very high pressures, right, as you go lower in water, right, the pressures increase. So things like nitrogen, right, can actually dissolve in your blood. So things that normally don't dissolve in your blood, right, because again, remember, under increased pressure, solubility increases, right? So under normal circumstances, things that will ordinarily not be able to dissolve in your blood actually become able to be dissolved in your blood like nitrogen. So if that happens, and then you come up to the surface very quickly without giving enough time for equilibration, then that nitrogen can undissolve, because you are reducing pressures, that nitrogen can undissolve out of your circulation, and that can begin to occlude vessels. It can occlude coronary vessels, cause a massive myocardial infarction. It can occlude pulmonary vessels. It can cause like a pulmonary embolus, right? So those are things you all want to keep at the back of your mind. And the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they know that, oh, the only situation people seem to think about with this stuff is, oh, just think about the bend, think about Caisson's disease. But one thing you also want to keep at the back of your mind is that these things can also happen in people that, like, they can literally give you a very similar presentation in a person that's getting some kind of line placed in them, either like an arterial line, although I'll say on MBME exams, probably one that's probably a little more common is like a central venous, like a CVC, a central venous catheter, right? Those things can introduce air. Those things can introduce air into the blood vessels. And when you introduce air into the blood vessels, that can ultimately go ahead and cause occlusion of things. And the person can get ischemia from that. So that's, again, a high yield presentation you want to keep in mind. Now, okay. So what if you get a question about a 55-year-old female, has a history of breast cancer, she has had an axillary lymph node dissection, and she complains of, she's been complaining of like arm swelling and arm pain. What's your diagnosis for that patient? Well, I hope you're saying that this person's got a lymphedema, okay? Lymphedema. Lymphedema is a fairly common complication of a lymph node dissection. And classically on the MBMEs, they tend to test that in the context of a person that has had an axillary lymph node dissection for breast cancer. Now, what if they then tell you that, oh, this woman, you know, she has had this lymphedema for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden, like over like a 3-month period, she starts having like profound weight loss, massive swelling of that extremity, and like the extremity begins to appear like edematous and necrotic, what are you thinking about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about some kind of malignant degeneration. The thing is, when a person has chronic lymphedema, it can degenerate to form some kind of sarcoma. It can either become like a lymphangiosarcoma, right? Which is probably the most common thing you'll find on exams. Remember, a lymphangiosarcoma is just essentially an angiosarcoma of a lymphatic channel, right? So, and again, the prognosis is terrible, terrible, terrible. Now, what other angiosarcoma are you familiar with in the body that's tested on the USMLE exams? Well, I would hope you're thinking about like angiosarcomas in the liver. Remember, those are pretty common in people that have been exposed to PVC, so like polyvinyl chloride. That's actually, again, something that your friends at the MBME love to test. And again, these angiosarcomas, they have a terrible prognosis. People that have angiosarcomas, they let's just say they don't do very well. It's not something that a person you would wish on anyone. It's a terrible, terrible thing to have. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? And this patient, you know, is a long-term IV drug user. And then they give you some labs, and this person's CD4 count is like 20. And then they tell you that this person has been having like bloody bowel movements, right? And then they tell you that, oh, they perform like an EGD or they perform some kind of colonoscopy. And they tell you, they will likely go after the EGD on the exam. They tell you that, you know, an EGD was performed, and they see like multiple like red and purple nodules in the person's lining the person's gastric mucosa. Under those circumstances, what's your diagnosis? I would actually hope you're thinking about Kaposi's sarcoma. Right? Remember, Kaposi's sarcoma is an AIDS-defining illness. And the classic presentation, right, it can either present on the skin or it can present in in visceral organs, right? It can present on the skin, it can present in visceral organs, right? So they'll basically describe a person that has all these like red or like purple nodules on their skin or in their GI tract. That's Kaposi's sarcoma for you. And hopefully you want to remember that couple. And I mean, the reason it's red and purple, right, is that the tumor in general, like the lesions in general, contain a ton of blood vessels, right? So that's why they tend to have that color. And remember that Kaposi's sarcoma has an association with what bug? Well, I was hope you're saying HHV-8, right? So like sometimes it's called KSHV, Kaposi's sarcoma herpes virus. So HHV-8 has a definite association with Kaposi's sarcoma. And remember that in general, I mean, you can treat Kaposi's with chemotherapy, but for the most part, Kaposi's sarcoma is something that if a person's CD4 count is adequate, then they should not have Kaposi's sarcoma in the first place. In fact, there are some people that they have Kaposi's sarcoma, you start them on antiretroviral, like highly active antiretroviral therapy, and they get a lot better, and then they don't, the Kaposi's sarcoma just kind of like disappears pretty much. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, IV drug user, has multiple sexual partners, and they tell you that he appears cachectic, and he came into the hospital complaining of like severe chest pain radiating to the back. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about like syphilis, right? Again, IV drug user, multiple sexual partners. The person probably has some antecedents of tertiary syphilis, right? And in this case, the person, I mean, presenting like the severe chest pain radiating to the back, they probably have an aortic dissection, right? Because remember, syphilis, right? If you remember very early in this podcast, I talked about the three parts of a blood vessel, right? I said we can have the intima, we can have the media, and we can have the adventitia. And I said that the adventitia can contain certain blood vessels known as the vasa vasorum, right? And syphilis loves to infect the vasa vasora. And when it infects the vasa vasora, it can cause ischemia of the aortic wall, and that can cause an aortic wall dilation, right? So the person can have aortic root dilation. So syphilis can actually lead to aortic regurg because the aortic root is all dilated. That's one. Another thing that syphilis can cause, right, is it can cause aortic dissection because, again, you are weakening the walls of the aorta because by killing off the vasa vasora, then you're not having enough blood flow to the media, right? And that can kind of weaken that muscular wall, right? And then another thing that syphilis can cause is just a thoracic aortic aneurysm, right? Because again, when you have ischemia, right? Ischemia is typically followed by dilation of an organ or a blood vessel. I mean, if you think about the heart, if a person has a big myocardial infarction, almost all those people ultimately progress to getting some kind of a dilated cardiomyopathy. So that's like a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with syphilis. And remember that this aortitis that's associated with syphilis is something that you find as a part of tertiary syphilis. And one high yield thing you may see on the test is pathologically, when a person has a syphilitic aortitis, there is typically like this tree bark appearance of the person's aorta. Okay, there's a tree bark appearance of the person's aorta. That is a boss phrase. You absolutely want to make sure you remember for purposes of your exam. And I mean, obviously, what causes syphilis, right? Well, hopefully, again, let me try to integrate some micro here for you. Remember that syphilis is classically caused by Treponema pallidum. Okay, remember it's a spirochete. I'll tell you this, that there are two high-yield spirochetes you want to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams. Treponema pallidum is one, and then the second one is Borrelia burgdorferi, the bug that causes Lyme disease. Those are two very high-yield spirochetes that show up all the time on exams, right? So what are some high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with Treponema pallidum, right? You want to remember like the diagnostic testing, right? You want to remember that, especially if a person has like primary syphilis with a painless chancre, you can actually do dark field microscopy to see the bug, right? It's like a corkscrew shaped organism. And then you can also do like a screening test. They're called a non-treponemal tests, right? Like the RPR test. RPR stands for like rapid plasma Roentgen test. test, or you can do the VDRL. I think it's like the Venereal Disease Research Lab or something like that, right? Those are the non-treponemal tests, right? They are good screening tests. But the thing is, remember, for every screening test, this is a concept that I know Pathoma discusses quite extensively. For every screening test, you always want to follow it up with some kind of confirmatory test, right? So if a person has syphilis, right, and you know, the VDRL, RPR is positive, because those things are not very sensitive, because like the RPR test, for example, is like a test that detects like anti-cardiolipin antibodies. Anti-cardiolipin antibodies are found in many diseases, right? So you cannot say, oh, your RPR is positive, so that means you've got syphilis. No, you cannot say that with any degree of certainty. So you typically want to follow it up with a test, like confirmatory test, that is more specific, right? And those confirmatory tests are like treponemal tests. Remember, RPR, VDRL, those are non-treponemal tests. But these other tests like MHATP, right? So like it's like a microhemagglutinin assay against a treponema pallidum. That's an example of a confirmatory test for syphilis. Or there's this other one known as FTA-ABS. It's like a fluorescent something antibody test for syphilis. So FTA-ABS, MHATP, those are tests that, those are confirmatory tests for the diagnosis of syphilis. And remember, again, like I said, primary syphilis is the painless chancre. Tertiary syphilis is like the otitis, the tibis dorsalis, where you scrub the dorsal columns, right? And when you think of secondary syphilis, you want to think about the rash on the palms and soles, or you want to think about condyloma lata, right? Those are all big things that tend to go with secondary syphilis for purposes of the USMLE exams. Now, what if you get a question about a 65-year-old guy, and this guy comes in? He says that, oh, doc, for the last like 2 months, I've been having pretty significant leg pain. Whenever I walk like a block, it begins to hurt a ton. And this person has maybe smoked like 2 packs of cigarettes every day for the past 40 years. What's your diagnosis? Well, I hope you're saying that this person has peripheral arterial disease, right? If they ask for your next step in management on the exam, you want to go ahead and perform an ankle brachial index, right? So you want to go ahead and get an ABI, and it will typically be less than 0.9, and you're like, oh crap, this person's got a PAD. And one thing they may ask you on your exam is, what do you do for treatment, right? Typically for treatment, you can consider doing things like a supervised walking program, right? That's one thing you can consider. If a supervised walking program doesn't pan out so well, you can give this drug known as celostazol. Celostazol is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It's an antiplatelet agent, actually, believe it or not. But it's also a very good vasodilator, so you can use it to pharmacologically help a person that has PED. But the thing is, if all that is not working and the person is having like leg pain at rest, they are at very high risk for like gangrene and like permanent ischemia of the extremities. So under those circumstances, you need to consider placing like a graft, like you can place like an endovascular graft or like a stent to relieve the obstruction and improve perfusion to their extremities. And again, the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease on MBME exams is smoking. Okay, the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease is smoking. Now, what if they give you a question about a pregnant woman? You know, she delivers a baby, and then they tell you that within three hours after she's delivered the baby, she becomes completely unresponsive, becomes comatose, and she's not, the physicians cannot get anything from her. And then they give you like a blood pressure, is like 40 over palpable, and she's like super, super, super hypoxic. What's your diagnosis under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about like an amniotic fluid embolism, okay? This is the classic presentation of an amniotic fluid embolism on MBME exams. Basically, the thing that happens is whenever a woman is about to deliver a baby, right? She's been pregnant for a while, and then the water breaks, right? So the amniotic sac breaks. That amniotic sac, when it breaks, you know, typically all the amniotic fluid just goes out the vagina, right? But in some unfortunate cases, that amniotic fluid can actually gain entry into the vascular tree and then go to like a pulmonary artery, for example. Amniotic fluid, believe it or not, it can actually embolic process, right, is what's known as amniotic fluid embolism. Okay, so amniotic fluid can actually occlude vessels, like it can occlude the pulmonary vessels, and it can cause like a sudden death, like from like a very nasty like it's almost, it's essentially like the same pathophysiology as a pulmonary embolus. It's just that the thing that's embolizing in this case is amniotic fluid. That's why it's known as amniotic fluid embolism. That's the classic presentation, and that's something you actually want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you like a similar presentation, but they tell you that, oh, this person, you know, was is a patient that has recently undergone like orthopedic surgery. And again, the person has like, the person is becoming confused, having petechiae on the skin, complaining of severe shortness of breath. And they show you like some labs, and you notice that the person's O2 sat is like, I don't know, like 50, right? So obviously the person is hypoxic. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about fat embolism. Okay, think about fat embolism. The classic presentation is a person that has like recent orthopedic surgery. Because the thing is, think about if a person has like recent orthopedic surgery, or they have like a bone fracture. Remember, your bone contains bone marrow, right? And there's a certain part of your bone marrow that's known as yellow marrow that literally contains fat. So that fat again can embolize and occlude a person's like pulmonary vessels, and that can cause something called fat embolism syndrome. Now the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they realize that every human being that's a med student has, you know, very effectively memorized this whole long bone fracture or orthopedic surgery association. So these days they're beginning to put some, you know, little more exotic things that can cause fat embolism syndrome. So if a person has like a history of like fatty liver disease, or a person is like a burn patient, those are actually things that can precipitate fat embolism syndrome. Because really, anything that just makes you have a ton of fat running around in your circulation can absolutely cause fat embolism syndrome. So those are some unusual presentations you actually want to keep at the back of your mind that may actually show up on an MBME exam. Okay, now, what if you get a question about you know, like a 65-year-old guy, his BMI is like 40, and he smokes a ton, and they tell you that he comes in with, you know, like chest pain, relating to the job, blah, blah, blah. What's your diagnosis for this guy? Right, this is a STEMI, right? That's an easy one. It's a STEMI. And how do you treat STEMIs in general? Well, the first thing you want to give that patient is aspirin, right? You give that patient aspirin. And then there are some other medications you can give, but that's more for the purposes of step 2 CK, so I'm going to skip that. But for the most part, you give aspirin. And remember that the most commonly occluded vessel in a person that has a myocardial infarction is actually the LAD, okay, the left anterior descending artery. And you also want to know that whenever a person has like an RCA infarct, those people, the way you actually treat an RCA infarct, at least initially before you take them for percutaneous or coronary intervention, is actually to consider giving them fluids, okay? I mean, you don't give them a crap ton of fluids, but you give them fluids, right? And you want to remember that in those people, nitrates are actually contraindicated, because those nitrates, right, they are venodilators, so that will decrease their preload. And when you have an RCA infarct, you become very, very preload dependent. I'm almost certain I've described the mechanism behind this in some other cardiology podcasts, so I'm going to keep moving, right? So in general, the primary treatment for an MI is percutaneous or coronary intervention. The only time you use a thrombolytic is when you're like more than 2 hours away from a hospital or a center that is capable of percutaneous or coronary intervention. So when you do a PCI, right, one high yield thing your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to remember is that when you do a percutaneous coronary intervention, you typically place a kind of stent known as a drug eluting stent, right? A drug eluting stent. So it's a stent that essentially the walls of the stent are impregnated pretty much with like an mTOR inhibitor like sirolimus, right? Or you can actually also impregnate those walls with, although this is less commonly done, with a microtubule inhibitor like your paclitaxel and stuff like that, right? Because the thing is, by putting these drugs, right, cells lose the ability to proliferate, so that you don't have like smooth muscle cells and all these inflammatory cells coming and essentially like clogging off the stent you just placed. That is actually a very nice way that your friends at the MBME can integrate immunology with cardiology, right? So that's something you actually want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if you get a question about, this is just, I guess, a concept you want to be able to keep in mind, but Remember, if you ever see petechiae on a person's skin, what is the very first thing that should come to your mind on MBME exams? I would hope you are saying that this person likely has some kind of thrombocytopenia going on. Okay, whenever you see PTKI on your MBME exams, the first thing you want to think about is thrombocytopenia. Now, what if you get a question about a patient? You know, this patient is like 4'5" tall, and she has like a low posterior hairline, and she has like her neck kind of looks, you know, it's kind of swollen, and they tell you that, oh, she has a history of horseshoe kidney. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would hope you're thinking about Turner syndrome. If you notice, for this cardiac pathology podcast, I'm focusing a lot on clinical vignettes because I think that's a very effective way to cover at least the bulk of the high yield material with a cardiac path. So I'm just going to keep doing that pretty much. So this person, right, you know, has got Turner syndrome, right? And Turner syndrome has a lot of cardiovascular associations that your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know. Okay, so one is that you want to remember that these people can have bicuspid aortic valves. Okay, bicuspid aortic valves are actually pretty common in people that have Turner syndrome, and that can increase their risk of having like thoracic aortic aneurysms and having aortic dissection. So if you see a chest pain in a patient that has a history of Turner syndrome, you really, really want to think about aortic dissection or some acute aortic syndrome, right? That's complicating their clinical course. And remember that Turner syndrome, right, is 45XO, right? So don't mix that up on your test. Now, quick question for you. What's causing the person's neck to be enlarged and swollen? I would hope you're saying that that's a cystic hygroma. The thing is, the reason I'm mentioning this, right, again, this is a vascular pathology podcast, so I'm talking about like diseases of arteries or veins and of capillaries. The thing is, your friends at the MBME realize that every human being has memorized the term cystic hygroma. So they are beginning to, you know, get a little more effective at messing with people's heads by changing the name, right? Because the thing is, cystic hygroma is actually an example of lymphedema. Believe it or not, it's actually an example of a congenital lymphedema. Because, I mean, it's not like a tumor or anything like that. You're like, oh, hygroma, so it must be a mass. No, it's not a real mass. For the most part, it's just problems with the proper development of the lymphatic channels in the neck, right? And that's what causes that problem in people that have Turner syndrome, okay? And remember, again, Turner syndrome is 45XO. Very high yield to know that for purposes of exams. So, now, what if you get a question about a child, and it's like a 3-month-old child, and his parents come in, they're worried because this child has like a red raised lesion, like on the face or on the back or in the lower extremities. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're telling me that this person likely has a capillary hemangioma, right? The thing is, there are some unique questions that your friends at the MBME love to test in the context of these capillary hemangiomas. They may ask you that, what's the most likely clinical course of a capillary hemangioma? Well, the most likely clinical course is it may rapidly expand and then it will regress. Almost all of them regress as the child gets older, right? So those are lesions that you generally do not do anything for, okay? They are lesions you generally do not do anything for. Okay, now, so what if you get a question about a 40-year-old guy and he's getting like a CVC, right? So like a central venous catheter placed. And then they tell you that 10 minutes after the CVC was placed, I remember a CVC, right? Central venous. Whenever you see the term central venous, just think of it as a $5 word for right atrium on your exam. You're just literally placing a catheter in the person's right atrium. Okay, that's where it's supposed to be, right? So they tell you that, you know, 10 minutes after placing the CVC, the patient starts complaining of severe chest pain, and they become profoundly hypoxic, and their blood pressure goes down a ton. What's your diagnosis under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about our pneumothorax. Okay, remember, in the placement of, again, lines in the chest, right, you can puncture the lung and give rise to a pneumothorax. That, again, that's just, again, a high yield presentation you want to keep in mind. So what would your next step in management be under those circumstances? Well, you want to go ahead, right, and do a needle decompression, right? You want to go ahead and do a needle decompression. You can do it like in the second intercostal space in the mid-clavicular line, right? Or you can do it in the fifth intercostal space in the mid-axillary line. And then after you've done, when you do the needle decompression, that will convert the tension pneumothorax to an open pneumothorax. And then after that, you place a chest tube. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has been on a long car ride, and this patient has, like, is complaining of, like, severe leg pain and swelling. Like, let's say it's just one leg that is swollen, it's tender, it's, and this person has been on, like, a 20-hour car ride or something like that. And then they tell you that, oh, this person recently had, like 2 days ago, had, like, brain surgery, and that brain surgery was complicated by a bleed, and they've also had, like, a history of GI bleeding, like, 3 months ago. What would your next step in management be under those circumstances? I mean, obviously, this person's got a DVT, right? Would you want to start them on, like, anticoagulation? Probably not, right? If a person has had, like, recent, like, neurosurgery, like a brain bleed or, like, a GI bleed, those are, in general, on MBME exams, are contraindications to anticoagulation. So under those circumstances, your next step in management will actually be to place in an IVC filter, okay? Those IVC filters, they essentially prevent... at least they can prevent a large clot from going from the leg, because a DVT is very likely not going to kill you, but a PE is very likely to kill you, right? So under those circumstances, the thing that happens on MBMEs is you place an IVC filter, and that IVC filter will prevent the propagation of the clot. At least if it propagates, at least it will not get into the person's pulmonary vasculature and cause a massive PE. Now, what if they give you a question about a 45-year-old female? Let's say she's like Gravida 4, para 3, right? So she's had like multiple pregnancies. And let's say this woman is like super, super obese. And then she comes in and says that for the last 6 months, she's been having a lot of like leg pain, okay? And she says that she notices that by the end of the day, her leg is swollen, and it's both legs. What's your diagnosis? Well, I would hope under those circumstances, you're thinking about chronic venous insufficiency. Sometimes those are known as varicose veins. What are some key things you want to keep in mind with the MBMEs? Well, you want to remember that those things are associated with the pathophysiology, right? Is when a person has incompetence of the valves that line the veins of the lower extremities, okay? That's a high yield thing you want to know. And then you want to know, like, again, some key treatment options that you could explore in these patients, right? So you may see, Devon, you're going very clinical today. Again, I know I'm going very clinical, but that is the direction that the USMLE is taking these days with step one, right? Like, they're still testing a lot of basic science concepts, but they're now beginning to test it in like clinical contexts, or not even, they may not even necessarily be like going after like a clinical sounding answer. But the thing is, they may present the information to you in a very clinical way. So I want to essentially train you with these kinds of podcasts to recognize those things in the first place. Because if you can recognize it, then the step one exam becomes very easy. And one area that they love to do this clinical mumbo jumbo, classically, is with cardiology, right? So that's why I'm, again, really hitting that stuff hard. So the thing is, in general, for treatment, right, you can do things like you tell them to, you know, like elevate their legs, because that will encourage drainage back towards the heart, so that the fluid doesn't hang out in the veins. And then you can also use something known as an UNA boot. It's like UNNA, like an UNA boot that really helps with their symptoms. And the thing is, if these people were to develop an ulcer, like an ulcer on their lower extremities, where would they most likely develop that ulcer on the MBME exams? Well, I hope you're telling me that they will develop that ulcer above the medial malleolus. Or even if it's not above the medial malleolus, at least it's going to be on the medial side of their lower extremities, okay? But classically on MBME exams, it's almost always above the medial malleolus. And again, remember that these people, they can have like a dermatitis that arises from this chronic venous insufficiency. Because if you think about it, right, because the valves are not working, blood is collecting in their lower extremities. And as that blood collects in their lower extremities, that will cause extravasation of like that will like raise hydrostatic pressures in those veins. And you can have like extravasation of red blood cells. And as those red blood cells are broken down, you begin to have like these like deposits of hemosiderin in the person's like the layers of the person's skin. And that can cause something called a stasis dermatitis, right? So the person's skin kind of looks like reddish brown, but it tends to look like edematous, okay? And unfortunately, these things are very, 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 very hard to treat. Now, one thing that your friends at the NBME can test in relation to these things is they can say, What is a likely infectious complication of a person having like stasis dermatitis or having like chronic venous insufficiency? Well, you want to think about the good old cellulitis. Cellulitis is a relatively common complication of having a prolonged history of stasis dermatitis or chronic venous insufficiency. And I guess one last thing I'll mention with chronic venous insufficiency is that you can actually make the diagnosis by... You can actually make the diagnosis by doing like a Doppler ultrasound of the lower extremity. And in this day and age where your friends at the NBME care a lot about risk factors, they may ask, they may give you a question like, you know, they may describe like, you know, like a classic patient. And then they can say, oh, which of the following historic risk factors in this patient increases their risk for this presentation? Well, here are some key things you want to know. If, for example, a person has had multiple gestations, right? That can increase a person's risk of like varicose veins, right? Because again, if you have multiple gestations, you essentially live extended periods of your life where the uterus is gravid, it's big, and it compresses on the IVC. And that can increase the hydrostatic pressures in of the veins that line your lower extremities, and that can cause varicose veins. Another thing that can cause varicose veins, another risk factor, is if a person just, you know, works in a career that involves like standing a ton, right? Let's say like you're rounding for hours and hours and hours, like 10, you're rounding for like 10 hours every day for like years and years and years. That can actually increase a person's risk of varicose veins. And also if a person is obese, obesity certainly can increase a person's risk of varicose veins, right? And then if a person is just old and frail, that can also increase their risk of varicose veins, right? Because think about it. The thing is, the muscles of your lower extremities, they, as they contract, they actually push blood up towards the heart, okay? So they prevent blood from like hanging around in the person's veins, right? So it's almost like those muscles, they almost like massage your veins, right? So the thing is, as a person gets old and frail and they begin to have all this muscle atrophy, you lose that muscle contractile effect. I mean, your muscle will still contract if you're not going to be able to move, right? But you lose that muscle contractile effect, and if you lose it, you're not able to like squish on those veins and send blood back to the heart, and that can increase a person's risk of varicose veins. So again, these are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, what if you get a question about like a 35-year-old female? She comes in, she tells you that whenever she steps out into the cold, her fingers hurt a lot and her fingers turn blue. Like it, you know, it kind of like turns white and then it turns blue. And then she says, but once she steps back into her apartment, her finger, like fingers kind of pink up again. They become like red again. What's your diagnosis? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about like a Raynaud phenomenon, right? A Raynaud phenomenon, remember, it does not arise from atherosclerosis. It classically arises from like vasospasm, right? It's a vasospastic disease. Let me go ahead and mention this. There are two high-yield, this literally just dropped in my mind. There are two high-yield vasospastic diseases you want to keep at the back of your mind for the USMLE exams. One you want to keep in mind is Raynaud's phenomenon. That's the very first one. But the second one you want to keep at the back of your mind is Prinz Medal Angina. Okay, Prinz Medal Angina. Remember, Prinz Medal Angina, the name has actually changed. It's no longer known as Prinz Medal Angina. It's now known as Variant Angina. Okay, those are two vasospastic diseases, and they kind of have, again, kind of similar pathophysiology where, again, the person has a spasm of vessels. It's just in Raynaud's phenomenon, people have like spasm of their digital arteries. In people that have variant angina, they have spasm of their coronary vessels. Okay, And these people in general, right, you can treat those people with dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So like amlodipine, that can typically help with the vasospasm. And you just tell them to avoid the cold. Although for Prince Medal, the thing is, one way that your friends at the NBME can sort of like stretch this concept a little further is you actually want to know that people that have these vasospastic diseases, they should actually try to avoid vasoconstricting drugs. You want to avoid drugs that can cause vasospasm, right? So these people, right, ergotamine derivatives are not a great idea in them. Sumatriptan is not a great idea in these people, okay? Those are high yield things that you want to know for purposes of the USMLE exam. And then, who are the people that classically get Raynaud phenomenon on the USMLEs, right? So these are people that have like crest scleroderma, right? Remember the crest, like the C is for calcinosis, the R is for what? Guess what? Raynaud phenomenon, right? And then the E is for esophageal dysmotility, S is for sclerodactyly, and then T is for telangiectasias, right? These people tend to have Raynaud's phenomenon. And remember that crest syndrome is associated with anti-centromere antibodies, right? And then Raynaud phenomenon can also be found in people that have like Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, right, like hyperviscosity syndrome. Those people also tend to have Raynaud phenomenon on the USMLEs. And then just people that have like autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune diseases, especially like lupus, increase a person's risk of having Raynaud phenomenon on the USMLE exams. Now, okay. Now, what if you get a question about a patient, you know, that has a history of TB, and then they present with like hemoptysis, and they show you like imaging on the exam, and you notice that they have like this like TB cavity, and you see like this rounded mass inside the cavity, and then they may give you like some labs, and the person's white count may be like 15,000, which is high, and then they will show you that the person has like 10% eosinophils. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking about aspergillosis, right? Remember, aspergillus loves to form these fungus balls. That's one, right? But why am I talking about aspergillus in the context of like a cardiovascular pathology? Well, the problem is aspergillus can actually infect blood vessels. It can actually invade blood vessels. It can invade the... In fact, typically, this is why people that have like invasive aspergillosis have hemoptysis. It can actually invade the pulmonary vessels, right? And that can cause like fluid extravasation and all that badness, right? And then the person can get into trouble and begin to have hemoptysis. And the thing is, these aspergillus hyphae, they can also actually like just literally occlude blood vessels chronically. And that can actually cause like pulmonary hypertension, right? Or it can cause like pulmonary embolus. So these are all complications of aspergillosis you want to keep at the back of your mind. And you may ask, oh, Divine, how do we treat aspergillosis? Well, if a person has like invasive aspergillosis, on your exam, one thing you can consider giving is voriconazole, right? So you can give voriconazole or posaconazole. Those are very good drugs for treating aspergillosis. But another one you may also consider is amphotericin B, right? Essentially, if you have any invasive fungal infection, amphotericin B is almost always a good answer as to what you can consider giving the patient. So again, just key things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if you get a question about a 25-year-old guy? And this 25-year-old guy tells you that for the past 6 months, he had been having severe pain in his bilateral like hands. I don't know if I've talked about this earlier, but I want to make sure I cover it because it's very high yield to know. Severe pain in his bilateral hands. And they tell you that on physical exam, his fingers look like black and discolored. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're thinking, and let's say, okay, this guy, let's say for the past 10 years. So let's say he's 25, but starting at the age of 15, he started smoking like 3 packs of cigarettes every day. What's your diagnosis here? Well, this is Berger's disease. I'll spell that out because you don't want to confuse this with Berger's or Berger's or whatever. I don't know. But Berger's disease, B-U-E-R-G-E-R, okay? Berger's disease, right? Classic presentation, smoker, right? It'll be a young male that's a smoker, right? And has like gangrenous or like necrotic looking extremities, right? It's actually a kind of vasculitis, and for whatever reason, it loves to affect like medium-sized and small-sized arteries, okay? So it loves to affect like the radial arteries in the hands and the tibial arteries in the lower extremities, okay? And the thing is, again, classic presentation, young male, heavy smoker, okay? And they will be complaining of like pain in their fingers. They can even have like Raynaud's phenomenon. And really the only treatment for these people is just tell them, stop smoking and it will get better, okay? There are literally people that this disease can almost entirely reverse, if they stop smoking, right? And the thing is, if they don't stop, which unfortunately is the case for many patients that have this thing, they may like begin to develop like ulcers in their extremities, right? And then they can go into like gangrenous necrosis, and obviously they will lose that limb because that will have to be amputated. Although sometimes you can actually, believe it or not, I've actually seen this clinically, the extremity can auto amputate. It will just kind of fall off on its own from a necrosis. Kind of gross there. And one thing that your friends at the MBME, right, are beginning to do is they know that people have memorized like the classic names of certain diseases. So they're beginning to like test the same thing, but you know, they just put different words that still describe the same disease, but are a little different from what you're used to, right? So instead of seeing Buerger's disease on your exam, they may actually call this thing thromboangitis obliterans, okay? Thromboangitis, so like thromboangitis, okay? So thromboangitis obliterans. Obliterans is like obliterans, okay? So thromboangitis obliterans, that's again classic Buerger's disease. And the thing is, if you actually do like an angiogram of these people's extremities, you'll actually see like a corkscrew-like pattern. That's classic for Buerger's disease. Now, what if they give you a question about 30-year-old guy, he tells you that over the last like 3 weeks, he has been having a lot of like red urine, okay? And then he tells you that he has also been coughing up blood, so he's been having hemoptysis. And then they tell you in the question that, oh, that he has like a saddle nose deformity. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, that's Wegener's, right? That's Wegener's. Remember, the name has changed from Wegener's. It's now called a GPA, a granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Remember the classic triad, right? Hemoptysis, hematuria. The hematuria is from nephritic syndrome. If you want to be a little more specific, they have a rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis. And then they have sinusitis. But here is one thing you need to be careful of for purposes of the USMLE exams. Sinusitis can mean many different things on the USMLEs. Because again, your friends at the MBME, they realize that every human being has memorized that, oh, if you see a person with hematuria, hemoptysis, and like nasal polyps or like sinusitis, boom, Wegener's. So they're beginning to expand their definition of what constitutes sinusitis. So you may see things like a saddle nose deformity with those other two members of the triad. That's still Wegener's. You may see things like otitis media with those other two members of the triad. That's still Wegener's. You may see mastoiditis, right? So like pain behind the ear. Basically, any infection like in the ear, nose, throat, in the setting of hemoptysis and hematuria, is still Wegener's for purposes of your exams, right? And remember that Wegener's is positive for C. anca. Okay, it's positive for C. anca. Sometimes you may see that referred to on MBMEs as anti-proteinase 3 anca. Contrast this with P. anca that is positive in Churg-Strauss, which is also known as EGPA, aka eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? And also like microscopic polyangiitis. Those seem to be associated with P. anca. Remember, P. anca is anti-myeloperoxidase anca. Sometimes it's known as anti-MPO anca. Okay, and really the way you treat Wegener's for the most part is you give those patients a steroids and a cyclophosphamide. Remember, as you're giving those patients cyclophosphamide, you want to encourage like a lot of hydration, and you want to give them Mesna so that you can prevent the development of a hemorrhagic cystitis. You want to prevent the development of a hemorrhagic cystitis. And then remember that these these vasculitides, for the most part, they're examples of type 3 hypersensitivity reactions, okay? The examples of type 3 hypersensitivity reactions. But there is a very, so you form like an antigen antibody complex, blah blah blah, but there is actually one weird exception to that rule. And that's actually good pasture syndrome. Okay, good posture syndrome is actually an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? So you make antibodies against the glomerular basement membrane, right? So those people tend to have hematuria, right? But in addition to that, and you see the classic like linear pattern on immunofluorescence, right? But these people also tend to have hemoptysis. So if you see like a young male with just hematuria and hemoptysis, then think about good posture syndrome. They won't have any antecedents of sinusitis on MBME exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient, you know, is like a 32-year-old female. She's been having like chronic abdominal pain. Occasionally, she has like bloody bowel movements. And then they tell you that, they obtained some kind of angiogram of like her GI vessels. And they notice all these like aneurysms forming. And you see like almost like this beads on a string pattern with the superior mesenteric artery. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about like polyarteritis nodosa, okay? I would really hope you're thinking about PAN, polyarteritis nodosa. The thing is with PAN, it's actually very high yield to remember that it tends to cause problems with like the mesenteric vessels, especially the superior mesenteric artery. In fact, let me just give you this test taking strategy. If they ask you about a GI blood vessel and you don't like some pathology related to a GI blood vessel and you have no clue what's going on, you're completely blank out on your test, I will strongly encourage you to pick the superior mesenteric artery. Most GI pathologies that involve blood vessels in the GI tract is almost always linked in some way, shape or form to the superior mesenteric artery. Okay, so that's one. Next thing is polyarteritis nodosa, right? Again, like you have the classic like beads on a string appearance on angiography. Another key thing with PAN is that it tends to not affect the lungs. Okay, tends to not affect the lungs. That's one big thing to know. And then another final thing to know about, actually two final things to know about PAN is, PAN tends to be ANCA negative. Okay, so it's not positive for CANCA or PANCA. And then finally, you want to remember that PAN has a very strong association with hepatitis B infection. Okay. No one really knows why, or at least I haven't found a good enough explanation in the literature, but PAN has a very strong association with hepatitis B infection. Has a very strong association with hepatitis B infection. Okay, now, what if you get a question and they're asking you about just the treatment of PAN? Really, PAN, the treatment is about the same as Wegener's. You actually can give those patients steroids plus a cyclophosphamide. And the thing is, you actually want to treat PAN. When you don't treat it, you can actually increase the patient's risk of getting into, you know, a lot of serious trouble in the future. Okay. Now, what if you get a question on the exam and you talk about like a 55-year-old female comes in, she says for the past like 2 days, she has been having like a severe headache on the right side of her forehead. And she tells you that like 3 weeks ago, she was having pain as she was trying to chew food. What's your diagnosis? Well, this is giant cell arteritis, right? This is temporal arteritis. And one thing they may do on the exam is ask for your next best step in management. Your next best step in management for temporal arteritis is to strongly consider corticosteroids. They will try to trick you into doing like a temporal artery biopsy first. Don't do that, okay? Give steroids first and then do diagnostic testing later. You have up to like 3 days to do like a biopsy of the temporal artery to make a diagnosis, right? And remember that there are some other high yield associations with temporal arteritis. Like I said, like trouble chewing, right? Like pain with chewing. That's something known as jaw claudication, right? That has an association with temporal arteritis. Or polymyalgia rheumatica, that's another thing that also has an association, where the person has like painful proximal extremities, okay? That's polymyalgia rheumatica, which for the most part tends to respond to low-dose corticosteroid treatment. Contrast this with temporal arteritis that tends to respond more to high-dose corticosteroid treatment, right? And the reason that you treat first and ask questions later is that, in fact, I'll tell you this as a clinical pro. If you have a patient and you have any like whiff of temporal arteritis, even if you're not sure, you're like, you just have a headache, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. Treat first. Like, it's better to give people high dose corticosteroids and stave off like the inevitable blindness that can happen in a person that has temporal arthritis and say, oh, you know, let's make sure, and then they become blind, right? You don't want that. A one-day course of like very heavy steroids is not going to kill a patient. It's probably going to save their vision, right? So what's temporal arthritis, right? It's the most common vasculitis, right? It's the most common vasculitis. And for whatever reason, the inflammation that causes this problem tends to occur in branches of the external carotid artery, right? For the most part, it's usually the temporal artery, right? So the patient will typically have like pain, like headache, like on one side of their forehead, like over their temples, basically. That's why it's called the temporal artery, right? But the thing is, remember, they can actually have problems in any branch of the aorta, right? So like they can have problems like with the vertebral arteries, they can have problems with their coronary arteries, right? They can essentially have problems in any branch of the aorta, but classically on MBME exams, they tend to have issues with the temporal artery, okay? They tend to have issues with the temporal artery. And again, you want to treat so that they don't have occlusion of like, they don't have like problems with like an ophthalmic artery and then become a permanently blind. And again, remember that temporal arteritis, it will classically present in a person that is older than the age of 50 on MBME exams, older than the age of 50, and it's typically common in females on exams. And the thing is, if a person has a normal erythrocyte sedimentation rate on MBME exams, they don't have temporal arteritis, okay? Yeah, having a high ESR does not exclude it. Having a normal ESR does not exclude the diagnosis. But I'll just tell you that I don't think I've ever seen an MBME question on temporal arteritis where the ESR was not markedly elevated, okay? So that's actually something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then the close cousin of giant cell arteritis, right? Takayasu arteritis. This one, unlike giant cell arteritis that tends to affect like, like intracerebral vessels, Takayasu arteritis tends to affect like legit branches of the aorta, right? So it tends to cause problems with like the subclavian artery, right? So that's why it's called like pulseless disease. Remember, your subclavian artery is the primary blood supply to your upper extremities, right? So if they give you a question about a patient and this patient has like differential blood pressures in the arms, right? You want to think about, again, it will be a person that's less than 50, and it'll probably be a person that's of like some kind of Asian heritage, especially like someone that's probably like Japanese, right? That's why it's called Takayasu, right? It's very common in Japan, right? So that's like the classic presentation. And again, you know, they'll have like differential pulses in the extremities, or they may have like visual problems, believe it or not, or they can have pulmonary hypertension, because sometimes they can actually have involvement of the pulmonary arteries by Takayasus. But again, woman less than 50, okay, has a giant cell arteritis style presentation, right? And then they may show you like an angiogram, and you may see like a big branch of the carotid artery, and that big branch, they will typically like give contrast on the MBMEs. They will give contrast, and you'll see contrast, and then boom, you'll then see like clear space after a while. Under those circumstances, again, especially if it's a branch of the carotid artery, think about Takayasu arteritis under those circumstances. And for the most part, you treat that with corticosteroids as well. Now, as I round up this podcast, I guess there are some quick hits I want to kind of like mention, right? So what if they give you a question about like a 6'7" guy that presents with like severe sudden onset chest pain radiating to the back? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? That's aortic dissection, right? If a person is 6'7" tall, what do you think they have? I would hope you're telling me that they likely have Marfan's, right? Remember, Marfan's, it's a connective tissue disorder, right? So these people tend to be like super, super tall, right? And remember that Marfan's is an autosomal dominant, it's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. These people have like mutations in a fibrillin gene, right? Instead of putting fibrillin, they may put like FBN1 as the gene that's mutated. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. The thing is, fibrillin, it helps with maintaining the integrity of collagen fibers. So when people have problems with fibrillin, they cannot maintain the integrity of like collagen fibers, of elastic fibers and all that stuff. And that will begin to mess with things that contain a lot of collagen and elastic fibers, like the media of a person's blood vessels, right? And if the media becomes very weak, then that can certainly cause problems like aortic dissection. And you also want to remember, right, that aortic dissection is not the only thing that happens in people with Marfan's. Because think about it, again, this fibrillin is very helpful for maintaining structural integrity, right? So things like the chordae tendineae in the heart, things like the lens of the eye, they all depend on fibrillin for proper functioning, right? So if these things are not functioning properly, you can begin to have things like mitral valve prolapse. You can begin to have things like ectopia lentis, where the lens is dislocated upwards, right? That's a classic finding in Marfan's. These people can have like a thoracic aortic aneurysm. They can have aortic regurg because the thoracic aorta is like very dilated, okay? These are all classic things you may find in a person that has Marfan's. And again, chromosome 15, fibrillin defect. And remember that people with Marfan's, right, they can also get aneurysms in the circle of Willis, right? So if a person with Marfan's comes in, worst headache of their lives, yada, 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 right? Think about giving, a rupture of like a Berry aneurysm, classically from the anterior communicating artery, that's leading to their symptoms. Now, there are two, let me take two sidebars here that are very high yield for the exam. The first sidebar is differentiating Marfan's from homocystinuria. Right, this is a common mistake that people make on exams, differentiating Marfan's from homocystinuria. Well, here's the deal. First thing, Marfan's, right, those people have a Marfanoid habitus, they're tall. Homocystinuria, they also have a Marfanoid habitus, they're tall. That's one. Two, Marfan's is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Homocystinuria is inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion. Three, a person that has Marfan's tends to have their lens dislocated upwards. In a person that has homocystinuria, they tend to have their lens dislocated downwards. Four, Marfan's, the mutation is in fibrillin. In homocystinuria, the mutation is in an enzyme known as cystathionine beta synthase, so like CBS. Alternatively, it can be in an enzyme known as MTHFR, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. Sometimes they may call that enzyme methionine synthase. And then the final difference is that people that have Marfan's tend to have normal intelligence. People that have homocystinuria, they tend to have intellectual disability. Okay? They tend to have intellectual disability. So those are very key but very high yield differences you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams in people that have Marfan's. And kind of like differentiating it from homocystinuria. Now, second sidebar I want to take is knowing some classic USMLE buzzwords for certain disorders and some key risk factors. So I'll just reel these off, right? So if they ask you about like the buzzword pathophysiology for like mitral valve prolapse, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about something known as myxomatous degeneration. Okay, now what if they ask you for the buzzword pathophysiology behind aortic stenosis? Well, I hope you're going to be telling me calcification of an aortic valve, right? So calcification of the valve. What if they ask you a question about aortic dissection? What's the buzzword pathophysiology? Well, it's the buzzword pathophysiology is something known as cystic medial degeneration. Sometimes you may see it referred to as cystic medial necrosis. Okay, that's the buzzword pathophysiology behind aortic dissection. Now, what is the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection? It's hypertension. What is the biggest risk factor for a stroke? That's hypertension as well. What is the biggest risk factor for a myocardial infarction? That's smoking. What is the biggest risk factor for an abdominal aortic aneurysm? That's smoking as well. What is the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease? That's smoking. What is the biggest risk factor for mitral stenosis? That's rheumatic fever. What is the biggest risk factor for AFib? That's mitral stenosis. Okay? So notice, I just reeled out all these very high yield things. Again, you may say, ooh, divine, this is low yield for exams, yada, yada, yada. I promise you, it's not low yield. Okay? These are things that are tested all the time on step one, step two CK, step three. So that's why, again, I'm trying to like kind of like sit down and really hammer this into your heads. Okay, so let's keep moving on because I want to go ahead and end this podcast sooner rather than later. I've kind of talked about aortic dissection already, right? Some big things you want to keep in mind, right, is aortic dissection, right? There are two types of aortic dissection, right? There's type A and there's type B. Basically, the way you delineate those two is if a person has aortic dissection of any sort and it involves the ascending aorta, it doesn't matter if it also involves the descending aorta, no one cares. As long as an aortic dissection involves the ascending aorta, it's a type A dissection. Remember the A in type A for the A in ascending aorta, okay? And then if a person has an aortic dissection and it only involves the descending aorta, that is a type B dissection. That is a type B dissection. Why is it important to know that stuff? It's important to know that stuff because for every aortic dissection, right, if they ask what's your first step in management, give a beta blocker. You always give a beta blocker. You can give like propranolol, you can give metoprolol, you can give labetalol, it doesn't matter, right? But the thing is, a type E dissection is treated with surgery in addition to that medical therapy of a beta blocker. A type B dissection is treated exclusively medically, right? So you just give the beta blocker and call it a day. So that's a big thing you want to keep in mind with aortic dissection. Now, another high yield thing with aortic dissection is that it tends to, there are some complications that can happen, like people can have like aortic rupture, right? And that's obviously bad. Mortality is probably like almost like 70-80% for those people. And then aortic dissection can also cause strokes, because when you have like a retrograde dissection where it begins to go back towards like the aortic root, that can cause a stroke because you can dissect and cut off blood supply to like a cerebral blood vessel. But another thing that can happen is that in the presence of aortic dissection, you can also dissect back and begin to cut off blood supply to coronary vessels. The most common coronary vessel to be impacted in a person that has an aortic dissection is the right coronary artery. That is a factoid you absolutely want to commit to memory for the purposes of your USMLE exams. And then remember that classically on imaging, people that have aortic dissection, they tend to have a widened mediastinum, okay? And again, people that get aortic dissection on exams, people that have really severe hypertension, right? People that have Marfan's, people that have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, right? People that have Turner syndrome, right? These are all people that have syphilis, right? Like a syphilitic aortitis. Those things can all increase a person's risk of having aortic dissection. Some other things they may even put on exams with aortic dissections, they may say that, on imaging, they see like two different lumens in the ascending or the descending aorta. If you see that bus freeze, think about aortic dissection, okay? Think about aortic dissection. And again, aortic dissection, I mean, it's bad. You want to treat it because, it can get bad real fast, right? Now, one other thing you want to keep in mind, right? What if they give you a question about like a 65-year-old guy, he has smoked for like 2 packs a day, 40 years, right? And then he presents with like severe back pain, right? And they tell you that on physical exam, he has a pulsatile mass, right? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I really hope you're thinking about an aortic aneurysm, right? Like a triple A that has ruptured, an abdominal aortic aneurysm. Remember that abdominal aortic aneurysms is very high yield to actually remember that they arise below the renal arteries, right? So like in the infrarenal aorta. And the biggest risk factor for a triple A is smoking. And if you remember when I talked about, like the rupture of an atheromatous plaque, I said that one thing that can increase a person's risk of rupture is if you have like increased expression of matrix metalloproteinases, or if you have like a very thin fibrous cap. Those are all risk factors for an increased increased risk of a rupture. The thing is also having increased expression of matrix metalloproteinases increases a person's risk of rupture of an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And the classic presentation on MBME exams is the person will have like severe back pain, because remember, your aorta is, at least your descending aorta, is retroperitoneal, right? So they may not have abdominal pain, they may have like back pain on an MBME exam, right? So you see a person that has like long-term smoker, old guy, severe sudden onset, it's not something that they'll say, I've been having for weeks, doctor, no. Right, you can have a rupture triple E for weeks, you know, the person will be long dead, right? So, thing that happens is sudden onset, severe back pain, low blood pressure, pulsatile mass on physical exam. When you see those things, think about a triple A, right? And the thing is, in general, for a triple A, right, like you want to typically screen people, you know, if a person has smoked for a long time, you typically want to like start screening them at the age of 65. You do like a one-time abdominal ultrasound. If you notice that the abdominal aorta, like the diameter is more than 5.5 centimeters, that's typically an indication for repair. Okay, you want to go ahead and repair that. There's some other weird things they love to test there that I won't go into. Those are more step 2 CK material. But there is one thing that's actually step 1 worthy material that they love to test with recourse to fixing a triple A. The thing is, when you fix a person's triple A, one thing that can happen is you can actually, during the process of like fixing the triple A, you can actually have something happen where you have ischemia of an artery known as the artery of Adamkiewicz, okay? You can have ischemia to an artery known as the artery of Adamkiewicz. The artery of Adamkiewicz arises from the aorta, okay? It arises from the aorta, And the artery of Adamkiewicz gives rise to the anterior spinal artery for many levels, actually, in the spinal cord, like the thoracic spinal cord, and also actually some, if I'm not mistaken, so don't quote me on this, some parts of the lumbar cord as well. Right, so if you have that, right, if they give you a question about a person that just had a triple A repair and then they have like paraplegia after surgery, think about disruption or ischemia to the artery of Adamkiewicz, okay, and that can ultimately cause an anterior spinal artery syndrome. That is a very nice way your friends at the MBME can integrate cardiology with neurology on an exam, okay? So again, very high yield to know this stuff. Now, I don't know why I'm having this these misgivings in my mind to talk about the other complications of triple A repair. I don't know, I have like this weird thought that it will show up on some person's USMLE step 1 exam and then I'll feel terrible. Okay, let me just talk about it real quick. So this, I'll say it right out, right now. This is probably low yield for step 1. It's very high yield for step 2 CK or step 3. But I don't know, I have like this bad feeling in my mind that it may show up on someone's test. So let me talk about it. I've talked about the artery of Adamkiewicz business with a triple A repair. Another thing that can happen with a triple A repair is that those people can have, let's say they can give you a question about a person, you know, has had a triple A repair like 3-4 months ago. And then this person presents with like, you know, like shortness of breath. And you check their hemoglobin, it's like 7. And then let's say you, which is low. And then let's say you measure their, you check their POP and their POP is hemocult positive. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would hope you're thinking about something known as an aortoenteric fistula, okay? An aortoenteric fistula. Basically, the thing that has happened is, in the process of fixing the AAA, you've led to like a tract that has formed. And this person has like a tract that has formed between the aorta and the GI tract. So the person is just chronically bleeding, and that can cause an iron deficiency anemia kind of situation. So an aortoenteric fistula is a relatively common complication. This is something that for whatever reason they love on like step 2 CK and the surgery shelf of fixing a AAA. Another AAA fix, another AAA fix complication on the USMLE exams is something called an endoleak. An endoleak is just something that happens where the aneurysm you think you've excluded, you begin to have like communication of that excluded aneurysmal sac with the stent or the graft that you've just placed. The classic way that will present is they may tell you that, oh, you know, this person is having like this person is complaining of like some mild abdominal pain and they have a history of like a AAA repair. And then they tell you that they perform like contrast angiography or like contrast aortography. And you can see contrast going beyond the confines of the excluded aneurysmal sac. Whenever you see that, think about an endoleak. There are many types of endoleaks, but that is beyond the scope of this discussion, so I'm going to move on. Okay, so those are the high-yield complications of AAA repair that you want to keep in mind. Another complication is just renal failure, because again, remember, AAAs tend to be right around the renal artery, although they tend to be below the level of the renal artery, but in the process of fixing a AAA, you can inadvertently occlude the renal arteries and cause like an acute kidney injury with that. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and this patient has, you know, like peripheral arterial disease style symptoms, you know, like, oh, doc, I walk one block, my leg starts hurting, and it gets better when I kind of rest for a while. And then, you know, you do the ankle brachial index and you measure it and you're like, it's like 1.4. I'm like, wait, but you have like what appears to be classic PAD. Why is your ABI 1.4? Well, whenever you see that, I just want you to think of two associations. One is that the person is likely a diabetic, And then two is that the person likely has something known as Munkeberg. So I'll spell that. It's M-O-N-C-K-E-B-E-R-G. Munkeberg calcific sclerosis. Okay. Basically, this thing tends to happen in people that have diabetes. And for the most part, they can have like calcification of the media of their blood vessels, right? So they'll have like a falsely elevated ankle brachial index. Okay. Usually people that have Munkeberg calcific sclerosis, they usually tend to not have any like, you know, like significant like problems. But that can be one unusual cause of a falsely elevated ankle brachial index. So they will tend to have like calcifications in the walls of their vessels, right? So if they show you like a histology slice through that vessel, you see a lot of like blue within the media. Think about, and they show you like, oh, the lumen of the vessel is relatively fine, like it's not super occluded. Think about a Munkeberg calcific sclerosis under those circumstances. It's very common in people that have a history of diabetes. And then I'm seeing that I really want to hopefully keep this podcast under 90 minutes, although I've talked about, again, a ton of high-yield stuff here. So I guess instead of just using vignettes, I'll just talk about the other key things I want to mention real quick. Remember this pathology, hyperplastic arteriosclerosis. They tend to present this as a histology picture on the USMLE exams. It'll be a person that they may show you like a person's blood vessel, right? And for the most part, the blood vessel will be occluded. And then you'll see that it actually looks like an onion skin, okay? Like an onion skin pattern to a person's blood vessel. If you see that, think about something called hyperplastic arteriosclerosis, okay? Hyperplastic arteriosclerosis. Okay, so what are some other associations you want to keep in mind with hyperplastic arteriosclerosis? You want to keep, basically, the big association I probably want to remember is a person that has just bad hypertension, like malignant hypertension kind of deal, like a person having like a scleroderma renal crisis, stuff like that. Those things can cause an accelerated arteriosclerosis, which again will have this onion skin pattern on a histology. And then another kind of arteriosclerosis you want to keep at the back of your mind is hyaline, so not hyperplastic. Hyaline arteriosclerosis. Typically, the thing that will happen is that, you know, you'll see like thickening of the person's arterial walls. Again, it tends to be common in people that have like diabetes and people that have like hypertension. And for the most part, you tend to see these arterial changes like in the kidneys and in the brain. And again, the classic thing is you'll see like a lot of thickening of the walls of the person's blood vessels. So personally, I think this podcast has maybe gone on for long enough, so let me go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring where if you're a first, second, or third-year med student, I tutor you for like your block exams or your shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exams. And again, people I've done this with, they've been wildly successful. I also do this thing called like a USMLE booster course where I tutor you for, it's like 10 hours for step 2 CK, step 3, and 20 hours for step 1. And it's good for a person that's at the end of their dedicated periods or a person that feels like the knowledge base is good and they want someone in a Q&A format. Very rapid, it's a super rapid review to put things together for them, like the must knows, the high yields for the exam. That's something I offer. And again, a lot of people have found it to be extremely helpful. It's probably one of my most popular courses with people right now. And then, if you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for the ABIM Internal Medicine Board exam or the Internal Medicine in Training exam, I also offer tutoring for that. And then if you have like a college body that needs tutoring for like the MCAT, general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you need like coaching or advising for like if you're like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I offer like one-on-one advising / coaching for like you know, like mock interviews, editing personal statements, rec letters, editing applications. Again, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for like a year. I've read thousands of high quality applications. I've worked with tons of med students that have all matched at their first choices. So in multiple specialties, and I've worked with a lot of international medical graduates. So again, if you need any of these things, feel free to reach out to me. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I am really glad the Lakers won their game last night. As some of you may know, I'm a big Lakers fan with Anthony Davis getting like 40 points and 20 rebounds in 31 minutes. I'm really excited for the Lakers this season. I really pray all the time that they remain healthy. But let me get off my soapbox for now. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you. God bless you.